On this edition of the Writers Showcase podcast, author Bob Mustin joins us to discuss his latest book, The Blue Bicycle. Welcome to this edition of the Writers Showcase podcast. I'm Phil Nasons, and I'm your host each and every week, bringing you writers from various genres, letting us know what they're up to, reading from their books, and introducing you to books and writers that you may or may not have heard of. And this edition is a writer who's been here before. This is his second time on the podcast. Please welcome the author of The Blue Bicycle, Mr. Bob Mustin. Bob, welcome back to the program. How are you tonight?
Great, Phil. Thanks for having me back. It's really a pleasure to be back with you.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much. For those who are new to the podcast, and we definitely have seen some increased traffic, they may or may not have heard of you. Can you give us a brief overview of who you are?
Sure. I was what was called a military brat, raised in a military family. Served briefly in the Navy before I had an engineering career. All during those years, I did some form of writing. I even wrote technical specifications at one point, which really is creative too. It's just in a different direction. I write pretty much full time now. Have increasingly written full time over the last 20 years, even while I was working as an engineer. My wife and I live in the Blue Ridge Mountains of North Carolina now, trying to live a nice, quiet life of creativity. We live in Asheville, North Carolina. It's really a nice community for creative people. My wife weaves. She does a lot of weaving, and I write.
Sounds like a perfect existence.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
I'm sure it is. I'm jealous. Now, where is your favorite place of all places you've been to actually sit down and write?
I think where I'm sitting right now, I have an office in the basement of our house, and it's quiet down here. I don't have a whole lot of temptations. I'm surrounded by three walls with guitars hanging on them, but they don't seem to tempt me when I'm writing. The only temptation I have to draw my attention away from my writing is the one all writers complain about, and that's the internet.
Yeah, the internet can definitely be a distraction, can't it?
Yeah, it's so handy.
It is handy. Now, you say you have guitars on the wall, so you play then, right?
I do. That's changed a little bit over the years. I've gotten where I don't use a flat pick very well anymore, but I finger pick mostly right now. I'm playing Renaissance music and classical stuff on nylon string guitars.
Ah, the nylon. That's the old school, huh?
Yeah, that's what I started playing. I started playing folk guitar years and years ago with an old friend of mine named Eric Taylor, who is a really talented Texas songwriter now. I've done a lot of things, played electric for a while, played folk music on steel string, acoustic guitar, and now I'm back to the nylon.
Yeah, that sounds like a lot of fun. Now, if you could live anywhere in the world, where would you live?
I think I would be comfortable living most anywhere. My family's heritage, both my mother and father's families migrated to the U.S. from British Isles. And my wife, her family has Irish heritage. So I think based on maybe my genetic predispositions, I would probably favor the British Isles somewhere. I'm not sure where. Maybe Wales.
Okay, I have friends in Wales. One of my longtime students who lived here in Corfu with her parents, her mother's from Wales. So I have a lot of Welsh clients. So I probably could live there too, but it rains a lot there, right?
Yeah. Hopefully it doesn't get as hot as it does in the southern part of the U.S. So
it doesn't, believe
me. I could stand the rain if the heat wasn't there.
Well, there's no heat there, so you'll be all right. Now, if you could live in any time period, what time period would that be?
I think I would probably pick the 14th century. That was the middle of the Renaissance era. Maybe I'm being influenced by my interest in Renaissance music. But I think my main interest is Geoffrey Chaucer. He wrote the Canterbury Tales. That was his time frame. And the Renaissance era wasn't as terrible a time to live in as a lot of people think. You had a lot to do there. There were constant wars and things like that, but probably no more than we have today. One of the things I think that draws me, and I may be laboring under a misconception, but from reading the Canterbury Tales, there was a lot of storytelling. And a lot of it wasn't remotely true, but people had fun telling stories. And I've always had fun listening to stories as well as writing them. And I'm not all that concerned with them being true as long as it's a good story.
All right. Well, you would fit in right well in Corfu, I'll tell you that. They tell some stories here. Let me ask you something. If you could meet just one writer, living or dead, who would that be?
I think that probably would depend on what I'm writing at the moment. I write from a lot of different perspectives. I've just finished writing a short story collection of weird stories, strange happenstance type stories. So I think based on that, Edgar Allan Poe would probably be somebody I would be interested in meeting. I don't really know a lot about Poe except what I learned in college and high school literature classes, but he might be a pretty interesting person to talk to.
Yeah, he was a pretty good storyteller, wasn't he?
Yeah. Creepy, but really, really talented writer.
He probably was like that in real life, too, a little creepy.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, well, to each his own. I kind of like it that way, actually. At least you know what you're getting. You know, he was pretty upfront. But how did you become a suspense writer, even though The Blue Bicycle isn't like a suspense book? That's the main thing that you do. How did you become a suspense writer?
Well, I think suspense is has to be a main aspect of whatever you write, as a particularly as a fiction writer, even as a nonfiction writer. A lot of nonfiction today is taking the form of some of the strategies that fiction writers have. And of course, suspense is one of those things that keeps a writer flipping pages. You know, you get to be 10 o'clock and you're a little bit sleepy and you get to a good chapter and you say, my God, what's happening on the next page? And you flip it over and before you know it, it's midnight. I think that's one of the biggest lessons I've learned as a writer, is to be that aware of what triggers interest in readers. I think most writers begin by writing mostly for themselves, but if you're really going to be successful at it, you have to really have your writers in mind. And writing with a sense of suspense in whatever you write keeps the readers going.
And you definitely do that, my friend. You definitely do that. You had me on all three of the books of yours that I've read. And I enjoyed that. I lost some sleep, but then I don't sleep that much anyway, so it's all good. As an independent writer, and that's technically what you are, right?
Yeah.
Do you have any marketing tips or strategies that you'd like to share for other independent writers?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest things is that you have to keep in mind that it's a really tough publishing world right now. There are a lot of avenues that you can make use of to learn how to write and to improve your writing. But it's not a given that you can get published these days. There's just so many people out there writing, and the competition is heavy, and the publishing industry is kind of turned upside down now by technology, and they're being bought out by conglomerates. So the advice I would have is that to any writer that is wanting to start writing or is writing and is seeking publication, is you have to use the same amount of creativity in somehow gaining publication that you use to write your stories. It's a different kind of creativity, but you have to be really creative. You have to think of different ways, different avenues to be published, different ways to have your stuff reach an audience. You just have to know what you're good at in that aspect too. Some people are good at editing, which gives you a good story. Some people are much better at promotion. I don't think I'm as good at that as I am some of the technical aspects of writing. Some people are better at teaching. You can gain a good audience that way, sell books that way. My main talent, I think, is an organizational ability and being able to facilitate all the different aspects of what it takes to get from beginning writing a book to getting published through an organization. That's one of the reasons I've entered into this writer's co-op that began just recently.
Excellent. We're off to a flying start. And after the music, Bob will be reading from his latest novel, The Blue Bicycle. And we'll be right back. You're listening to the Writers Showcase Podcast with Phil Nasons.
The Blue Bicycle takes place in Asheville, North Carolina, where my wife and I live. Asheville is a very vital little mountain city, but it is rural in a lot of aspects. The section that I want to read is in the second section of the book. The book is in four sections. And Artie Royal has become a teenager in this section, and he, by mutual consent between he and his great-grandfather, Merle, he's now known as AJ rather than Artie. And it's the 4th of July, and he's waiting for his girlfriend, Sandy, to pick him up. And Sandy is comes from a very rich family, and he's very conscious of his own poverty. And his grandfather, Merle, great-grandfather Merle, has some emotional and psychological problems, which include post-traumatic stress from his time during World War II. And Artie, or AJ, is very ashamed of his great-grandfather, Merle. And so as I open this section, he's standing around waiting for Sandy to pick him up. A cool July breeze slipped across Coley Street and whispered across Merle's long front porch. AJ rubbed a sprinkling of goosebumps from his arms, rose from his seat on the steps. Since coming to live with his great-grandfather, AJ had grown into a slightly darker, more muscular, and taller version of his father, Casey. He leaped to the gravel drive and searched out a patch of sky between the oaks. The clouds had moved southward, the electric smell of summer rain gone. Good. The fireworks show would happen after all, and Sandy was on the way. "When's she gonna get here?" Merle called out. AJ turned, watched the old man fan a gnarled hand at some unseen thing. A nearby dove added its hollow phrasings to the porch floor's creaks as Merle slumped back in his rocker. "Any time now, Merle." "This shirt I got on, it's a little messy." Merle bent forward, shuffled his brogans. "Don't want her thinking your Papa Merle's messy." AJ huffed and said nothing. "Sure do like that little girl." AJ jammed a hand deep into a jeans pocket, felt the ring at the bottom. He raked a sneaker through the gravel. If he were to try orchestrating a good impression for a rich girl like Sandy, it would take more than a clean shirt on Merle. For starters, he'd make this old house disappear. Everywhere he looked, embarrassment loomed. Grass and weeds stood a foot high. Merle had long since abandoned the shrubs to a swirl of vines. Lumpy, 100-year-old oaks standing between house and street were in desperate need of pruning. The roof's wooden shingles were split and rotting. Gutters hung limply, still drooling from the afternoon rain. A green scum had added its blight to the porch's once white columns. Inside, the house seemed a dungeon of gloom, the ancient wallpaper and trim painted over in two dark yellows and browns. Even the window panes had grown dim and foreboding with years of accumulated grime. AJ shook his head, bemused. Sandy had shown no sign of revulsion when she first visited. In fact, she seemed okay with the rundown property, the dingy house. Didn't even flinch when she'd met smelly old Merle. AJ straightened from his usual slouch. Then he glanced to his frayed, too short jeans, thought about changing his own shirt. But his other three were just as worn as this one. A pensive sigh. "Pretty soon, though, I'll be out of here. Away from Merle and his battle fatigue, his booze, his stinking poverty. It'll take a while, then it'll be just Sandy and me."
We're back on the Writers Showcase podcast. We're here with author Bob Mustin discussing his latest novel, The Blue Bicycle. Bob, The Blue Bike spans the Appalachians geographically from North Carolina to Nova Scotia. How did that come about?
Doing that in the book was all about connections, I think. The bike was Artie's connecting device. It connected him from his childhood through his teen years to his adult years to the time when he handed it off to his son and then later on too. But I wanted something that was more generalized, and his great-grandfather Merle was from Nova Scotia, and Nova Scotia is right at the northern end of the Appalachian Mountains. Asheville in North Carolina is more or less at the southern end, so there was this connecting device of the Appalachian Mountains. And I really wanted to show some extremes to life, and this was maybe a little bit of a metaphor for that.
Perfect. Now, Artie's great grandpa Merle is an interesting but tragic character. Can you tell us a little bit about him and how you decided to include him in the story?
Yeah, there were two projects that I had in mind with Merle. Merle was involved in some pretty heavy combat in the Mediterranean invasion of Italy during World War II. He had what was called battle fatigue back then. So he had these things that had worked his way into his psychology, and it troubled him. He had a drinking problem. He was hallucinating and basically making life miserable for Artie when Artie was living with him. So that was one aspect of Merle, but I didn't want to have this be a dirge. Merle also played the fiddle, and early on in the book, I wanted to have that. Merle was a really good folk fiddler. He taught his daughter and his granddaughter and great-grandson Artie to do these little Nova Scotian dances, and he played fiddle. And I thought that would go nicely with Artie's means of escape was riding the bike, and the music was yet another. I think that was a way of escaping the mundane and even more serious aspects of life for Artie and for his mother, Marie, and for Merle. Merle had his own problems, and I think music was his escape.
Yeah, that makes sense, and you're right. He's a tragic figure. Definitely so. You're going to appreciate, you readers, meeting Merle, though, because we all have a grandpa like him or someone in our family like him. Now, each of the four sections of The Blue Bicycle read differently, like different points of view from in different tenses. Why did you decide to structure the story that way?
When I decided to write this book, I was in kind of a period of insecurity with my writing. I had my first book had been published, and my publisher had gone broke. I had written a second one, had lost two contracts on it, and about the time that I started trying to work on another project after that, the publishing industry started being, maybe I should say, not particularly writer-friendly, and so I decided that I might have some problems with my writing, and I was determined I was going to find out what they were. So I thought if I wrote a book in four different parts and with these different variations and tints and points of view, it would be apparent that I had, if I had problems. So I wrote the book, did my best to edit it, the book, and I sent it to a freelance editor and just waited on pins and needles for about 3 months for her to give me a response back. And when she did, actually, she liked it. She said, "You shouldn't worry about your writing abilities. You're a good writer." So that resolved that issue with me. But the book primarily was written just to see if I really was a writer.
Yeah, that's kind of funny that you say these things, because I've read all your books and there's no doubt you're a writer. But I also understand the insecurities that artists have, because I have them too sometimes. So I get where you're coming from. You did an excellent job with the four different tenses and different points of view. I appreciated that part of the book. Now, a reoccurring element of your books is the Navy and Marine Corps. So that must figure in your life, right? Can you talk a bit about it?
Yeah. I don't think I realized it until I was into my late 20s, but my father had, he was a lifetime first sergeant, master sergeant in the Air Force. He had started out in the Army during World War II. He was all about the military, and I think he wanted me to achieve things in the military that he felt weren't available to him, and so he groomed me to be in the military. It just so happens that that wasn't my cup of tea. I pretty much followed that, went into the Navy briefly, got out as quick as I possibly could. That being raised that way and the military training I gained from being in the service, that sort of thing stays with you. And one thing that I always remember was while I was at the Naval Academy, of course, part of what you're having to learn in the military is how to fight in different ways. And we had to learn boxing. And I'm left-handed. And our boxing instructor was a captain in the Marine Corps. And he instructed us for, I guess it was about 10 lessons, 10 different sessions. And then we were to fight one-minute round for a grade. And, of course, they paired us off by size, weight mostly. And as luck would have it, I ended up with somebody else that was left-handed. Now, we were taught to fight as if we were right-handers, to fight right-handers. So both of us were fighting two left-handers. And so we just basically had a slugging match with each other. And we pounded each other pretty bad. And finally, the captain called the fight at an end. And my roommate came over to me. My face was all puffed up. My lips were bleeding. And he started laughing. I said, "What's the problem?" He said, "It's no problem. Just the captain, he got so into it that you fought for about 3.5 minutes. So that was that aspect of military life stayed with me, I think. I've always been combative in certain ways, even when I didn't want to be.
Yeah, that makes sense. Now, how important was it for you to place Artie in the Navy?
It was an arbitrary choice, I think. I there were certain things about the Navy that I wanted to portray, but mostly I wanted to add the metaphor of the sea out there. The sea was one of the, you know, I don't know if you've ever been to sea on a ocean crossing boat, but there's something really calming about sitting at the end of a ship or whatever as the sun goes down, you know, with nothing before you except water. It's just really calming. You know, in the Navy, you may live a fairly intense shipboard life, but the water's there, and whenever you can expose yourself to the serenity of constant water, it's really a great experience. And I wanted to add that to Artie's experience.
Yeah, it definitely was an experience. And this is a short read, like 150 pages in print. It's quite a departure from your other books. Why so short a book?
As I said before, it was something of an experiment, but the length and writing those four sections ended up just feeling right. I know that's not a very good answer. I also had in mind writing a novella, a fairly short form of the novel, which is an emerging form. A lot of British writers are writing novellas now and winning Booker Prizes and Pulitzer Prizes and that sort of thing. So the novella is not a second-class citizen in the literary sense. And short reads are probably more attractive than the really, really long reads now to people in our busy lifestyles, particularly men, who tend not to read much at all. And if they do, they want to read something short. So I also had that in mind, to write something short to try to get to do my bit to get men reading again.
Well, that's a good thing, by the way. Thank you so much for being on the program, Bob.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Phil. Thanks for having me again.
It's my pleasure, and good luck with the book and continued success in your writing. We look forward to hearing from you again very soon.
Thank you.
All right, and that's going to close this edition of the Writers Showcase podcast. There'll be a review of The Blue Bicycle on the Writers Showcase podcast blog, as well as philnasons.com at the Phil Nasons Media page on that blog. There'll also be a link to an interview that I did with Bob on my nationally syndicated sports program, The Phil Mason Show, that we conducted last Tuesday, and that link will be there. That's a different interview, and I invite you to check it out. Until next time, you all take care of yourselves. Thanks for listening, and enjoy the reading.